Welcome to Vashon 250. As America observes its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum have partnered to create our own recognition of this important milestone. We are looking back at what has happened in America since its beginning and examining how, over time, it has influenced our life on Vashon Island. In this second quarter of 2026, we continue to look at several of the famous high points that ultimately led to the Revolutionary War. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Holman. Today, we're looking at the battles of Lexington and Concord, the first major engagement between British troops and colonial militias, and the midnight ride of Paul Revere to warn that the British are coming, which incidentally was not nearly as colorful as the poem makes it out to be, but we'll stick with history. The context is the passage of the Tea Act of 1773 and the Boston Tea Party of the same year, which we talked about 3 weeks ago, and the resulting Intolerables Acts in 1774, and we talked about those a couple of weeks ago. The British Army had occupied Boston in 1768 to suppress colonial resistance after the Townshend Acts, and the troops were reinforced, and after the 1774 Intolerable Acts, to reinforce the new acts and to continue to suppress resistance. Suffice it to say, the British were unhappy.
Well, but it was also a continued escalation of tensions and continued conflicts between the occupying troops and the residents of Boston that set up the conditions for the battles of Lexington and Concord and the beginning of the armed conflict that became the American Revolution. Looking back at it now, it seems inevitable, and yet it was not. Either side could have de-escalated the growing conflict, but what prevented what prevented reconciliation was the colonists' outrage of having their traditional rights as British citizens being violated, and the king and parliament leaders in London feeling that the colonists were theirs to control.
And so on April 14th, General Thomas Gage, Commander-in-Chief, North America, and Colonial Governor of Massachusetts, received instructions to disarm the rebels, who were known to have hidden weapons in Concord, among other locations, and to imprison the rebellion's leaders, especially Samuel Adams and John Hancock. Paul Revere, a Boston silversmith and a member of the Sons of Liberty, that we've also discussed, had instructed Robert Newman, the sexton of the North Church, to send a signal by lantern to alert colonists in Charleston as to the movements of British troops when the information became known. In what is well known today by the phrase of one if by land, two if by sea, one lantern in the steeple would signal that the British were coming along the land route, proceeding southwest from Boston, while two lanterns would signal the route by water, across the Charles River. On the night of April 18, 1775, about 700 British troops moved troops across the Charles River and began a march toward Concord to destroy the military supplies stored there.
That evening, Paul Revere, William Dawes, and later joined by Samuel Prescott, rode toward Concord, warning of the approaching British. This was immortalized by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow in his 1860 poem, Paul Revere's Ride. And like most sort of things done 50, 60 years later, it sort of mythologizes a bit of what actually took place. But the poem begins, "Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere on the 18th of April in 75. So Revere and Dawes arrive in Lexington. They meet with Samuel Adams and John Hancock, and then they're joined by Prescott, and they ride on toward Concord.
The colonists had developed a system of alarm and muster, quote-unquote, to call out local militias and supporters, and within hours, colonial militia, the Minutemen as we know them, had begun to gather at Lexington and Concord. And the next day, April 19, 1775, the Battle of Lexington and Concord took place. The American Revolution became a war between American colonists, the British Army, and ultimately American loyalists, a true civil war within the war.
The very first shots between Patriot militiamen and regulars at Lexington were fired at sunrise on April 19th. Captain John Parker is reputed to have told the militiamen to stand your ground. Don't fire unless fired upon, but if they mean to have a war, let it begin here. 8 militiamen were killed, 10 wounded. Only one British soldier was wounded. The outnumbered militia quickly fell back, and the British proceeded to Concord to search for supplies. While Concord was being searched, about 90 British troops were met by about 400 American militiamen at the Old North Bridge and were forced to retreat in what Ralph Waldo Emerson called, quote, the shot heard round the world in his 1837 Concord hymn. This poem, along with Longfellow's Paul Revere's Ride, helped form the mythology of this beginning of the American Revolution. After the British had destroyed the 3 cannons they found and threw musket balls and barrels of flour into the mill pond, they began to retreat back to Boston.
And that retreat was a disaster for the British. The American militias harassed them all the way back to Boston, fighting in irregular but organized groups using the natural woods along the way as cover. During their retreat, the original British troops were reinforced by about 1,000 fresh troops at Lexington and then retreated back to Boston, numbering about 1,700 troops. The total colonial force that day included some 4,000 militiamen gathered from 30 surrounding villages. By the next day, over 15,000 colonial militiamen from all over New England surrounded Boston, and the siege of Boston had begun. The siege lasted for nearly a year and ended when the British retreated to Halifax, Nova Scotia, after the cannon from Fort Ticonderoga were brought to Boston and set on the Highlands. We'll talk about Ticonderoga next week. Patriots Day is still a legal holiday in Massachusetts in honor of this battle. So looking back on these events that were a seminal part of the Revolutionary War, there are numerous events since over the last 250 years that echo what happened. So, Bruce, what are some of the most significant of those historic events?
Well, let me set up a construct that will help us understand what has happened over the last 250 years. There's been numerous armed conflicts in American history, but I think it's helpful rather than looking at them as just armed conflicts, but try and look at them as what kinds of armed conflicts they were. And essentially, in my way of thinking, they break down into either progressive armed conflict, trying to bring about some kind of change, or reactionary armed conflicts, trying to keep things from changing. And if you look at the sort of American sweep of American history in that way, you can see that there have been numerous conflicts, but they're not all the same. They have very different motivations, and yet the motivations are very similar to the motivations that led to Lexington and Concord. It's still debated some among American historians whether the American Revolution was a progressive revolution or a reactionary revolution. On one level, it was a revolution to keep things the same way they were, no taxation without representation, which the English, you know, sort of common law provided for and what colonists thought was their rights. On the other hand, it's a very revolutionary revolution or a very progressive revolution, creating a whole new nation with a whole new set of principles about what it means to be an independent citizen, what it means to be a human being. And so built within that tension of Lexington and Concord, there's both a progressive and a reactionary element to it. I think when we look at the sweep of American history, it's helpful to break it down into those two sort of categories.
So let's do that.
Yeah, a few weeks ago we talked about the early rebellions like Shays Rebellion, the Whiskey Rebellion, Fears Rebellion, all sort of tax revolts, if you will. And in a sense, they're reactionary. They're sort of, those are actions to prevent things from changing, to keep things the way they are. And you have a similar thing in the middle of the Civil War in New York City with the draft riots, which were riots that largely turned into a racial riot. Black people were hung and beaten and driven out of the city because, whites didn't want to fight in the Civil War, particularly white Irish immigrants to the city. And so you have this sort of like, we don't want things to change kind of attitude, which I characterize as reactionary. But later on, after the Civil War, you have the Liberty Place sort of conflict in New Orleans, in which the White League, basically the Ku Klux Klan, fought to replace the duly elected black Reconstruction governments in the city of New Orleans. In 1898, in Wilmington, North Carolina, you had a segregationist violent riot that violently sort of burned much of the city, ran out the elected black Reconstruction city government, and sort of basically was a race riot. And then later on in the 1920s, you have the Tulsa race riots, all designed sort of to keep things as they were, to keep white people in control, to keep the economic sort of power in the hands of people who had it. And so you have those kind of what I would call reactionary, violent sort of revolts, very similar to one way of looking at Lexington and Concord. And then in the 20th century, we've had other kinds of things.
Yeah, well, if we look at 1993, and it's hard to believe it's that long ago, we had the Waco Branch Davidian compound siege that lasted for 51 days and ended up in a fiery mess and killed a lot of people.
Yep.
And then if we jump ahead to this decade, we end up, 2014, the Bundy standoff in Nevada, that was all about the government changing the lease for grazing. But the Bundys didn't want their lease changed, and it was done in some ways unfairly, and they protested. And then that was in 2014. And in 2016, they moved their cattle to a wildlife refuge just down the road and challenged the whole deal. And it was quite an epic battle at the time.
Yeah, and those those kind of revolts that are designed to keep things from changing. On the other hand, you have very progressive kinds of revolts. One that not many people know about is 1799, the attempt to create the state of Muskogee in northwest Florida, southern Georgia, southern Alabama, as an attempt to create an Indian nation separate from the United States. And of course, that was put down by Andrew Jackson, in part of the Indian Wars, and where Jackson begins to build his mythology as an Indian fighter,
yes,
that ultimately results in the Trail of Tears. So these things become kind of connected. But Muskogee was that kind of progressive, what I would call a progressive of attempt of creating a new sort of state or a new nation, if you will, an Indian nation. You also have John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry in 1859. I mean, John Brown's whole idea was to basically capture the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, take all the armaments, arm freed slaves, free slaves, arm them, and sort of create a separate, sort of free black nation, if you will. And so you get these kinds of violent conflicts that are organized around what I would call progressive kinds of values rather than reactionary values. They want to change things. I mean, the great railroad strike of the 1870s, 1877, was an attempt by railroad workers all over the country basically to assert their rights as workers, their rights to unionize, their rights to to sort of safety regulations and fair wages, again, to sort of resist this sort of monopolistic railroad industry that had emerged in the United States. And then you have the 1889 Johnson County War in Colorado, Wyoming sort of area, where it's essentially a battle between homesteaders coming out wanting to have their own land and the cattle barons who had sort of locked up huge tracts of land for their cattle ranches. And it becomes this real kind of almost revolutionary struggle between small groups of individuals and individuals wanting to have their own life and their own land against these massive landholders. And so you have a number of those kind of things going on.
In that case, would there have been a tension between what the cattle barons wanted and the Homestead Act, where we were trying to get people to move out west? And
yeah, it was, although the cattle barons got most of their land through the Homestead Act.
Okay.
I mean, so it's one of those things that it's not an easy, there's nuances, if you will, within it. But yeah, the whole idea of is the United States going to be a nation of small independent farmers, that kind of Jeffersonian idea of the yeoman farmer, or is it going to be, you know, these huge tracts of land controlled by railroads or controlled by cattle barons or controlled by mining companies? And that becomes much of the labor struggle of the late 19th century, is over that tension between what kind of nation are we going to be? You have another, I think, just fascinating conflict that occurs in 1946, right after World War II, in McMinn, Tennessee, often called the Battle of Athens. McMinn, Tennessee, during the war, had been controlled by a mayor and a sheriff who were just bullies, basically. You know, they just had taken over the town, and if anybody, you know, confronted their power, confronted their decisions, they were beat up or they were arrested and put in jail, you know, on no charges. And then these veterans from World War II come back, and they see what's happened to their town, and they just go in and they just kick ass and they clean up the town. Sort of like, which is sort of like Lexington and Concord.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to come take our militia's arms, you know, the weapons and the gunpowder. We're going to stop you. You know, so yeah, there's been a lot of that. And then, of course, during the civil rights movement, I think there's a number of those kind of things where the National Guards are federalized in Little Rock, Arkansas. In Mississippi, at the University of Mississippi in 1962, in 1963 at the University of Alabama, where George Wallace sort of stands in the schoolhouse door and sort of his, you know, sort of pledge was segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, and that sort of we're going to resist, you know, sort of segregating our schools, segregating our university. And the federal government, you know, stands up and says, no, you're not. You know, federalizes the National Guard, sends in military troops to enforce the law of the land. And so you have throughout American history this tension between these reactionary kind of actions where we want to keep things the same, and these progressive actions of, say, we're gonna make this change. And if we have to, we're going to use violence or force to bring about that change.
Well, and just the other evening, my daughter and I were watching something on TV, and I'm hard-pressed to tell you what it is, but it was built around George Wallace's this speech about segregation now, and then later on his run for president. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to think about what it would have meant had he actually mounted a credible campaign that won. Mm-hmm. That would be very different than what it was like with JFK as president.
Mm-hmm. Right. Very much so.
So, as always, we live in interesting times now. What would you consider to be some of the most significant events in the past, say, 5 or 6 years, that echo this Lexington and Concord first battle?
Well, I think...
Both nationally and locally, I guess.
Yeah,
I'll say.
Right. Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about Vashon in a few minutes, but I think, you know, nationally, of course, you have the January 6th sort of insurrection. And that's, it's important to step back from that and look at the thinking on both sides of that. The folks who were instrumental in creating that insurrection, certainly the people on the street, had this sense that they were saving the United States. They were preventing an election from being stolen, and no evidence that an election was stolen, no evidence of any impropriety in that election. But they were whipped up, in effect, to think about, we're going to lose our government, we're going to lose our nation unless we show up and violently sort of prevent this from happening. So again, it's a very reactionary kind of insurrection, to keep things as they were or how they saw them as they were. And of course, in American politics today, there is this very real tension between the progressive and sort of the reactionary wings of the American political system. To the point that they do often devolve into violence. And then you have the National Guard deployments that are going on right now around the nation and sort of how they are being viewed and how they're being accepted or not accepted by citizens within the cities where National Guard are being sent. You certainly have the ICE sort of mobilization in Minneapolis and the reaction to that and the resistance to that. So there are a number of things going on right now in terms of American politics where you see this tension between reactionary and progressive forces. And I think right now in 2026, those distinctions are very well articulated by sort of the MAGA wing of the Republican Party, that's a very reactionary, we don't want things to change, we want them to go back to the way they were, and the very progressive wing of the Democratic Party that's saying we desperately need change at a very deep fundamental level to create the kind of society that you read about in the Declaration of Independence.
So you have fundamentalists on either side.
You do.
Yeah. And I think concerning to when I look at the current activity in Iran, it doesn't. I'm really curious to know what the end game is. Because there wasn't really any planning for the Iraq war or any of our Middle Eastern activity in the last decade. We went in, but where are we going and how are we getting out?
Yeah.
And so the question is, what's the exit plan here? And we're gonna see history all over again.
Yeah, and that's what ties it back to Lexington and Concord is, the British didn't really have a plan other than to go get the orange, round up the
wear
munitions.
Wear red coats. targets.
But to round up the munitions so that the colonists couldn't resist. And the colonists didn't really have a plan other than we're not going to let you take, our munitions. And it's sort of out of that conflict that begins to emerge this construct of the development of, we're going to create a new nation. But certainly going into Lexington and Concord, nobody had that sort of in their head. I mean, a few on the extremes may have, and a few extreme sort of reactionaries in London, thinking we need to just slap this down and keep them in their place. In reality, it was a very unformed sort of set of concepts at that point. But once the shooting starts, the constructs become clear and begin to emerge very, very quickly. And I think if you look at Iran, here we are in 2026 with the United States, aligning itself with Israel and beginning a war against Iran. And it's sort of like, is that a progressive kind of war in trying to remove a sort of authoritarian religious regime? Or is it a regressive kind of going back to the way it was before the Ayatollahs came into power. What makes it so sort of nuanced, if you will, is that you've got to remember that in the 1950s, when the American government and the CIA overthrow an independently elected democratic government in Iran and install the Shah of Iran as an authoritarian dictator,
yes,
who is then overthrown by the Ayatollahs and create a very authoritarian religious regime, what are we doing? And it gets very confusing, and it's very difficult to say, well, this is a progressive movement or this is a reactionary movement, because it's deeply embedded within a very troubled past.
Yeah, and in our lifetime, we can go back to when the embassy was taken, and all of our people sat there for a mm-hmm. long, long time, mm-hmm. for a year or more, right. And that'll be interesting to see. So let's as we get toward the end here. Let's look at Vashon. And what do you think some of the events are that echo these recent occurrences, reactionary and progressive?
Well, on sort of the reactionary side, there's a very interesting incident in the 1930s at Liza Beulah. During the mid-late 1930s, of course, the Dust Bowl was taking place throughout the middle of the United States, and farmers are basically fleeing, from Texas all the way up into the Dakotas, and in the sort of mid late 30s, 36, 37, a group of African Americans from Arkansas settle in Liza Beulah. And there's these, when you go through the newspapers, I mean, there's these amazing sort of town meetings, if you will, of what are we going to do about the quote-unquote Negro problem at Liza Beulah. Because here's a group of people who don't fit, in terms of Vashon in the 1930s. And there's real discussions about, and you read through the newspapers. I mean, there's all this, they should go back where they came from. They should go back to places where they know how to deal with African Americans. They didn't use that term, but,
Yeah.
And so you get that sense that Vashon has confronted those kinds of reactionary, we don't want these new people coming in. And you see that in the 1970s with the hippies arriving on Vashon Island. That sort of Memorial Day concert sometimes the names just don't come. There was going to be a Memorial Day concert at the Jesus Barn. And of course, Islanders, this was a few months after Woodstock had taken place. And I mean, a lot of Islanders thought, oh my God, we're going to have another Woodstock on Vashon Island. And so they decided to create a sheriff's auxiliary and arm them to fight off this invasion of the hippies. And of course, the sheriff wouldn't have anything to do with that and help let them create a sheriff's auxiliary, but didn't let them walk around carrying sidearms. But again, it was that sense of, wow, what are we going to do with this influx of new people? And then, of course, with the formation of the Vashon Ferry District, and we've talked about this before, the Vashon Vigilantes. You arm a bunch of people to go down to the ferry dock to keep the ferry from landing so that they can't, take over from the Vashon Ferry District. So Vashon has its incidences of both progressive and reactionary.
Well, and if you drive through the town on any given weekend at the corner of Bank Road and the highway, there's always a protest of one kind or another. And that's what makes us what we are. That's a wrap to this episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us again each week through the end of 2026 for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island history. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic we might want to cover, please drop an email to vashon250@voiceofvashon.org.
Vashon 250 is a production of Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum. Our producer is Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services for business credit departments across the nation. For more information, go to nacmbcs.org. We appreciate their support. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.